Okay. Today is April the 2nd.
The 3rd.
Thank you very much. And we're here with Miss Vivian Follis to talk a little bit about her remembrances of urban renewal in McCraw and the Follis family. Can you tell me, do you remember when you met Bixie Follis?
I think it was around January 1950.
Do you remember how you met him? What?
He was standing on a street corner downtown. The old fire department was on Main Street.
Yes.
Along in, across the McClure building. I don't know if you remember where all that was or not. Mm-hmm. But it was there then. And so I was going down the street, and he said hello, and I thought I was my sister. And my sister knew another fireman, a younger one, Peavler boy that worked there at the fire department. And I said, I beg your pardon, but I'm not Carolyn, you know. Mm-hmm. And so we struck up conversation, and one thing led the other. And first thing you know, he asked me to come go to church with him. And I thought, well, you're the first man ever asked me to come go to church with you. And I said, well, all right. So I went with him, and it was the first Pentecostal church I'd ever been to. Huh? I'd heard of them, heard them call Holy Rollers, and we used to go out to Fish Hatchery swimming when we were all younger. Mm-hmm. And they'd be out there having a baptizing, just shouting on the creek bank, you know. And my girlfriend, I went with her parents, and they'd say, oh, that's those old Holy Rollers. And I didn't know, but little did I know, I was going to get involved with the Holy Rollers and found out they were the finest people that ever was, and it wasn't what people really mm-hmm. thought. So anyway, that's how I met him. And
when did y'all get married?
Wait a minute. July the 1st, 1951. 1950, because I met him in January, and then I married him in July. Yeah.
And was Mr. Follis at that time living in the old section, the Craw section?
No, he didn't live in Craw. He had owned a house in Bell Point, just as you go in, next to Hale's Grocery, old Hale's Grocery.
I see.
On Kentucky Avenue.
So you all set up housekeeping over in Bell Point?
Yeah, he bought about that time. He decided to rent that house out, and he bought one on the corner of Major in Kentucky. And that's where we moved into and started mm-hmm. living. And then after long in the spring, later on the following year, we had a baby girl, Bendelene Faith Follis. And after she was born, we bought a house down on 874 Kentucky Avenue. Mm-hmm. That was all down in front of Mr. Isaac Locke's property. He was our neighbor.
Oh, okay.
Mr. I.N. Locke. He was one of the oldest, most respected neighbors. And we lived there for about 25 years.
Well, can you tell me a little bit about, you had mentioned to me that you were pastor of a church. What denomination?
I was raised in a Baptist church, and then after Bixie asked me to come go to church with him, and I started, after we married, I started going with him to this Pentecost church. It was up on the hill, Pentecost Church of God. And his mother, of course, was a Pentecostal minister. And so we went there to church, and it wasn't long until, I really got saved. I'd never really been saved in my life. I just had gone to church, never experienced just coming to know Christ as my own personal Savior. And then along about that time, I received a call to the ministry.
Oh.
But I couldn't, I kept rejecting it because my people, they about made me leave home. They didn't believe in a woman preaching. And on the other hand, they didn't much want a lot to do with me then because I went to that church on the other side of the tracks.
Where on the other side of the tracks?
The other side of the tracks was from down at the trestle,
okay.
Railroad trestle that divides, runs across Broadway and divides Wilkson Street. And from the trestle on down toward Hemp Factory Hill,
mm-hmm.
that was the other side of the tracks, and that was going down through Craw.
I see.
And where I started the church was just a little down beyond Craw, up on the hill of Wilkson Street.
Okay, would that be sort
across from the sandbar.
Oh, okay.
The sandlot. Godeke's sandlot. And so, of course, they didn't like that. And I told them that... Well, God called me, and the Bible said that I should fear God more than man, and they could just run me off or do anything they want for getting saved and going to church. I said, you didn't prove of me drinking and dancing and partying and running around, and now that I got saved and I've given up all that and I want to work and live for the Lord, you're not pleased with that either. So I'm going to do what God's called me to do.
Did they reconcile themselves to your decision after?
Finally. I became a very a believer in the prayer and in the Word of God. I read the Word and what it said. I believed that it said do that. And so then I began to pray for God to really save my family. I said, now they say, I'm Baptist, I'm Methodist, I'm Church of Christ. But I said, y'all don't go to church.
Yeah.
You don't never see you sit around and read the Bible. I don't never hear you pray. But you claim to be such good Christians. And so anyway, I really prayed. And one by one, then my father got down on his deathbed. And had a stroke and heart attack. And they called all the family in. And Bixie and I went out. Well, my father, he couldn't talk. And he motioned, grunting and motioned me into his bed. And I went in and I began to pray for God to touch him and save his soul. Not let him die unsaved. Mm-hmm. I asked my father, I said, are you a Christian, Daddy? And he said, mm-mm, just like they couldn't talk. It affected his speech. So he motioned me closer. And I said, you want me to pray with you? Mm-hmm. So I prayed with him. And then he wanted me to read the Bible to him. And I read him the 23rd Psalm. And my father got saved. So then, little by little, it took a while, but they didn't much appreciate me going to Pentecost Church. But little by little, when the members of the family get sick, they'd want me to pray. They found out that when I prayed, things happened.
Can you tell me about your congregation? Who composed the congregation? Were they residents of the Craw?
Yeah, most of them. Most of them.
Black and white? And
not many black. Some of the black would come in and visit and sit on the back seat and visit, but they didn't participate. Of course, there were black churches around in that area that they went to. But after I got called to preach, and Chick Perkins built this church, and then he wanted to go out on the field and the evangelistic work, so the board asked me if I would take it. I had a call, would I take it? Well, from the day I got saved and got my call, I began to walk the streets of the bottom and knock on doors and ask people to come go to church, and if they were saved, and ask them if they weren't, let me pray with them.
What kind of conditions did you find as you went?
Some of the conditions were so pitiful. There was this one man I kept wanting to win to the Lord, and when I go to his home, in this front room, this front part of the house, they would have coal piled in there.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd be sleeping on that coal pile. And there'd be tin cans and chicken bones and everything just thrown in there and just lived in that. And he was black as ace spades, but he was a white man.
Huh.
And he was covered with sores. So I asked him, I'm going home and I'm going to get some, I got a scrub brush, a bottle of Clorox, and some clean clothes of Bixie's. And I went back down there and I told his wife, I said, you see he gets in a tub of water and you see that he's scrubbed and clean and I'm coming back and take him to church. Well, I want you to know he agreed to go, and when I went back that night to get him, took my kids with me, I didn't recognize the man. The neighbors had gotten so thrilled over him being willing to go to church and seeing what had happened to him, they were out there on the sidewalk shaving him and had him ready to go. And he got in the car with me, and I took him to church, and everybody was shocked because my pastor used to live his life down that bottom before he got converted. And so anyway, that was the beginning of it.
Were those kind of conditions, the ones that you just described, typical or atypical of residents of the bottom?
Not all of them. There would be some of them, their homes was clean as a pin.
Mm-hmm.
You could just about look like eat off of their floors, and their homes just spotless.
Mm-hmm.
And but this was just one particular incident that was
memorable,
exceptional in filth. But that man really did get saved, and I preached my funeral. I preached his funeral. I think it was the first funeral I preached. And they wouldn't even let him be. His wife and them wouldn't let him be buried at the funeral home, and they asked me to have a graveside to funeral. And he was put in an old pine box. And I cried. But then as I read the scriptures, I thought of the angels of God carrying him home to the bosom of God, you know.
Well, let me ask you some more about your evangelistic work there in the bottom. Were the residents pretty receptive to your overtures? Yes.
You know, and to be a woman minister, there was a few that would say they didn't believe in a woman preacher, and I'd quote them the scripture that a woman was the one carried the first message of Christ's resurrection from the tomb.
Mm-hmm.
And so they couldn't argue the Bible. But then most of them, they came into the church. It had 10 people coming when I took it over, when Chick left. And it grew until we was overflowing, and we moved the church then from down in the crawl, as you call it, to over in Bell Point, and we bought the old Nazarene church.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then I got in sick and had to give up the church and put the church into the Church of God, affiliated with the Church of God.
It had been independent prior
to that? It had been an independent church.
Uh-huh. Well, let me stay on this subject a little bit about Craw, in the sense that it was a community, just from what you saw down there, was it a neighborhood where people were neighborly to each other, or was it mostly vagrants?
They were more neighborly to each other than people like we live around where, well, of course, this neighborhood's wonderful. It's unusual that people here are so neighborly. But most places, somehow or another, they did for one another and looked after one another.
There was a sense of community, and that people did sort of take care of each other.
And if they didn't like you, it was Katie barred the door.
Ah, okay. They would.
And I had a brother, who's now dead, that was an alcoholic. And when he'd get on his drunks, he would head straight for the bottom. And when he did, every one of those people would take him in, take care of him. And I was pastoring the church, and one Sunday afternoon, one of the men come over and said, Sister Fowler, said, your brother's laying on the front porch in Catfish Alley. And so it was pouring down rain. And said, he's out cold, and they're stealing his clothes, his shoes, and everything off of him. So I called Johnny West at the jail. He was the jailer. Johnny come down and got him mm-hmm. for me. But that's the kind of people they were. They looked after their own.
Mm-hmm.
But when I went down there, and I carried my Bible in front of me because I was scared to death.
Was it a violent place?
At times, yes. My brother, when he sobered up and found out I was going down there, going door to door and walking the streets and going in those homes and all, and talking to those people about the Lord, he said, whatever you do, Susie, you keep your mouth shut. Don't never tell anything you see going on down that bottom. Because he said, if you do, you'll wind up here in the Kentucky River with a concrete block tied around you. He said, now, I'm just warning you.
He makes it sound like there were people who had interest in ensuring the things.
But I was so ignorant of what could have gone on. I didn't know. I never saw anything go on to tell, for one thing, other than because I guess when they see me coming, I was an outsider, so they began to shut the doors to those kind of.
When were you doing the work? In the late 50s or?
1951 till, let's see, what year was the church? Whenever the slum clearance came, they called it. When that ended, that ended my work down through there.
How did you react when you heard about the slum clearance? I mean, do you remember how you heard about it and what your reaction was?
Of course, it was in the papers, and they, were letting us know that we were going to have to move our church, we're going to have to sell our church and find another one.
How did you react to that news when you heard it?
Well, I thought it was a better thing for the town, for the community, and for the people down there, that they would be moved out into better places than what they were. Every time the flood came up, the water came up, that'd be the first place to go down in there, those homes around from the trestle on down. And my husband had statewide transfer business, and he'd be the first one with a truck down there and move all those people out.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was, of course, they called it the Crawl because it was always filled up with crawfish and everything else every time the river come up. But he would move them out. I did have some of his papers he received from the Red Cross for his services he did all down through there. But that's what it was. But I walked the streets and knocked on doors and invited people to church. And one man, Ike Quire, he's dead and his wife and all of them gone now. And I went into their home. His wife was coming to church, but he said, no, nobody never get me in there. Well, I went in his home one day, and I knelt on my knees in front of his rocking chair and began to tell him how much Jesus loved him.
Mm-hmm.
And
You know, tears started streaming down that man's cheeks. And it wasn't long, that man come to church and we baptized him.
Well, did you attend any of the public hearings that they had about the urban renewal?
My husband took care of it. See, we had a board, and so I let the board and my husband, that's the part of the church he helped take care of.
Oh, I see.
And
so you didn't participate in any of that?
Not unless it was necessary for me to be in the business meetings. Now, when the church was put in order in the Church of God, and we had to go to Bob Herod, who then was, I'm not sure if he was judge then or not, but anyway, he was the attorney that my husband had, and I went then. I had to sign some papers to get it affiliated with the Church of God.
Mm-hmm. So the affiliation took place at the time that you all relocated?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right after that. Because just as a church itself, the people, they weren't satisfied in moving. It's hard to move a group from one location, that a life they've always lived and a kind of people they've always been. Mm-hmm. I learned right then it's difficult to uproot them and put them into a totally new environment. They don't accept that readily.
So maybe urban renewal was sort of a mixed blessing to some of those people if they didn't want to see their church uprooted and they themselves.
The homes, to them, those homes were little ramshackle places. Like I said, some they scrubbed their linoleums clean and whitewashed what they could, but they loved it. And when they were uprooted and thrown out to other places, some went, couldn't have been any worse. But they just all scattered.
Mm-hmm. That's a theme I've heard from a lot of people, that yes, our homes weren't the most modern and up to date, but it was a neighborhood and it was our home. And I've heard some people reacted adversely to urban renewal because of that. They lost that neighborhood, that sense of being a home.
That's the way it was.
Would you consider the Craw a slum?
What would you term a slum?
Well, that's the tricky part. I guess solely on the condition of the housing and the utilities servicing the housing and the state of the buildings. Some people will go on that definition if the housing doesn't meet a certain code. Others will say a slum is a place where lower socioeconomic classes live, where there's excessive violence, gambling, vice, an area of high crime or prostitution.
It was all those things. It was all those things. And Alec Gordon, when I was a little girl, and my mother and father moved to town, lived over on 3rd Street in Vogler's. We rented a home from Vogler's, Doc Vogler's mother. I can't think of her first name now. And Alec Gordon's wife and family lived on the opposite corner from us, on the corner of Logan and 3rd Street. But Alec run a place down in the bottom. He lived two lives.
Oh, really? What place did he run now? Which place was it?
It was one of the worst gambling saloons,
like
vice, prostitution, you name it. It was all.
Like a Tiptoe Inn or the Blue Moon or something?
That's what it was.
The Blue Moon?
And I don't know if that's what they call. I've forgotten if they call. Anyway, John Follis and my husband had a place along in that same block close to Alec Gordon when John Follis was living. I've got a newspaper clipping from, I've forgotten, the State Journal or one of the others. It had a title that tall, John Follett, Czar of the Underworld, is killed.
Huh.
And I had that pinned up on my wall in my antique shop one day. And I came home and that was gone. Somebody stole that off the wall out of my shop.
Good grief.
Well, now the State Journal, I've got some pictures and writing I got from their paper. But I don't remember whether this must have been a Lexington paper or Louisville paper. Uh-huh. And then the Courier Journal, they had to let the Historical Society have a picture of the man that shot John Follis. And they gave me a copy of that. So I've got that.
That Rigsby?
Rigsby.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you, you say before your husband met you and came to the Lord, he was involved with his dad in running a place.
Well, after his daddy died, of course, when his daddy got killed, he was too young to run a place. But then as he got older, him and John Hackett run a place together. John Hackett worked the fire department, too.
Was that the Peachtree, or do you...
You know, I don't know the name of it to my... Well, that my daughter somewhere has got another album that belonged to Miss Follis. she's not home, but it had a lot of things, pictures and information in it. But anyway, he run a place, and every time they would, he would bootleg, it was during what you call prohibition. And he has told me that he would fill up a second gas tank, what looked like a gas tank, and he would run booze that way.
Mm-hmm.
And he and John Hackett, if they'd hear the revenue men was coming, they would pour it all down the sink and flush it down the sink or down the commode.
So this would have been the 1930s, probably. This was after
evidently, his dad before I met him, because I didn't meet him till first part of 1951. 51. I believe it's 51. And anyway, he bootlegged, and then he said he got saved just before I met him. Mm-hmm. And so then he give up. He said he was still married to his first wife. And he said he poured everything he had down the sink and put a padlock on the door and walked out when God saved him, and he never went back to it. He didn't drink or smoke himself.
I had heard in his, you know, from stories from R.T. Brooks and others that John R. Follis was something of a Robin Hood. He could be very good and passionate and kind to people, and when people down and out on their luck, he would carry them at his store or something like that. And I've heard similar stories about your late husband, Bixie, that sort of cut from the same mold, could be very good. And I've heard that...
High-tempered, extremely high-tempered.
Yeah, he came by that probably from his daddy. But I understand at one point he got into a conflict with the fire chief and was shot in some kind of dispute over repairing toys or something.
Didn't like to be told, didn't like to be bossed or told. He always took things to... how should I say the word? But he would get...
personal?
Yeah, maybe. And you had to be awful careful how you said whatever you say to him. If you didn't, well, you'd be quick to knock your block off.
I heard a story. I'll just relate this to you. Do you remember Charlie Hines?
Yeah.
He used to run the historical study years and years ago. Charlie, for some reason, went out to, I guess, your all's house. This would have been the late 50s. And Bixie was sparring around with, I don't know, do you all have some sons, or maybe from the previous marriage or something? And he got so excited, he was sparring around with somebody, he turned around and hit Mr. Hines and knocked him to the floor. And Charlie leaped up and said, "Why'd you do that, Bixie?" And he said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't." He just got caught up in the
didn't
moment of it.
Didn't aim to do that.
He was apparently, good with his fists and exercised.
He was a very good-hearted person. And I always called him a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. When he was good, he was just good as he could be and as thoughtful and helpful to everybody in the world as he could be.
Mm-hmm.
But he could get so mad. One day I stepped on his toe and he knocked me flat.
Oh, really?
Just that quick, something would rile him.
And he'd just something.
But then he'd turn around and pick you up and won't kiss you. And I said, "No, once you hit me, don't you try to kiss me. You leave me alone till I cool off." I'm that way.
Well, I heard there was I guess it's in the back of this, there's a text of a newspaper article. It doesn't give the exact date. It's on the last or second to last page, where apparently, and this is before you met him probably, someone shoved Mr. Follis, Bixie's wife.
Uh-huh, down here on Broadway.
And there was a horrible fight.
Yeah, Carlos, was quite a fighter too, the older brother that was state representative.
Yes.
Well, he came along and he got into it. So
what
it turned
year?
Out to be, there's, I think I've got a write-up.
Do you know what year that was?
I wish I'd got out that folder before you came, that I've got all the Follis stuff in it. And a lot of clippings and everything. Well, that was 40s, I reckon. But I'd have to get that
apparently
paper to be
sure. It was quite a Donnybrook, though. Somebody hit Bixie over the head with a shovel or something.
Yeah, Lord, I tell you, they were scared of him. And they knew that he was like his daddy, and he'd fight to the kill. That's the kind of person he was. And I loved him, and yet I was afraid of him. He was temperamental.
Let me ask you a little bit more about Craw. I'm taking up a lot of your time here. Were most of the folks that you encountered when you went door to door doing your evangelistic work, were most of them poor, or do you know what economic status they would have had?
Well, being poor and living in the cross section, if they did the underworld things that some of them did, it gave them money that wasn't.
Yeah.
brought over. But on the whole, they were considered poor.
Mm-hmm. I just wondered if it was integrated. Were there blacks and whites that lived down there?
Yeah.
That's what I thought. Some people had told me it was strictly blacks, but I didn't...
No, it wasn't. Black and white both lived down in there, and the black was just as good to me as gold. Treated me with respect. And I'll tell you another thing that I look up to today, Mayor Paul Judd. I asked him right after we moved the church from the crawl over to Bell Point, you know, they were talking about atom bomb shelters and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, would you consider coming to our church, which was a very poor congregation, illiterate. I taught a lot of them to read and write. I said, would you come and speak on the atom bomb and bomb shelters and stuff? Well, he did one Sunday morning. And that man, when service was over and everybody left, I looked at back at the door as I was preparing to leave, and there he stood holding his hat in his hand. And when I got back there, he looked at me and he said, Sister Follis, he says, I'm not the kind of Christian I ought to be. Would you pray for me? And you know, when that man would see me uptown in the Frankfurt Drug on Main Street or anywhere, that man always tipped his hat to me. And that was the most humbling feeling from anybody, to think the mayor of the town tipped his hat to me. And I'll never forget that just before he started tipping his hat, he told me one day in the drugstore, he said, you know, you're going to have to hold the noise down of that Pentecost church over there in Bell Point. Says people that go live around over there and go to the ball game are complaining about the noise. Now turn around real quick. And I said, Your Honor, let me tell you one thing. If anybody holds the noise down, you're going to have to tell that football field to hold that noise down. We can't hear the preaching or the singing, and the people roar by there in their cars and disturb our services. So if there's any quieting down, you do the quieting of that neighborhood.
Ah, okay.
He looked at me.
He was probably...
Yes, ma'am. From that day on, that man tipped his hat to me. But he never no more ever said another word about us holding the noise. And I said, we're shouting and for the glory of God. And I said, oh, what y'all shouting about down here at that ball field? But it sure makes a lot of noise. I can't even sleep where I live down here at the other end of Kentucky Avenue.
I need to find some people that knew Mayor Judd, because apparently at one point during the slum clearance project, Mayor John Girard, went out of office, sort of lost out to Mayor Judd, and the slum clearance project got into a little bit of political controversy there, and Mayor Judd wanted all the people on the slum clearance board to step down, and he wanted to appoint all, I guess, his people.
Yeah.
And I haven't talked to anybody yet who knows what was behind all that.
You know, it's funny how many things I forget that I hadn't even bothered, wasn't any use to think about, I reckon, all that stuff.
Well, it's interesting to me. Let me read you a few names of businesses and churches down in Craw and see if you have some reactions to them. The Tiger Inn. Remember the Tiger?
Tiger Inn. Was Can't it? Think of that one, but I knew a lot of the others. 20 Grands.
What was 20 Grands?
20 Grand, you know, they run a place, I guess, about as ornery, if you want to use that term, and wicked or whatever, corrupt or vice. But that man and Grace Sarvin, I don't know if they ever married or if they just lived together. I've never really found out.
Who was the man?
20 Grand, they called him.
20 Grand.
They called him 20 Grand. And what his right name was, I don't know to this day, but all I ever knew him by was 20 Grand. And he run what they called 20 Grands. It was his place.
Where was that?
Right down in the middle of Crawl on...
Washington? Or?
No, it wasn't on Washington. It was on Clinton or Miro. Where all the rest of them were along there, across the Wilkeson Street School now. I don't remember if it was Miro or Clinton. What's the first one after you leave Broadway going down that way? Do you ever?
Clinton parallels Broadway, and that's
on,
the first one.
On Clinton, I believe. Well, anyway, make a long story short, he sent for me one day. I scared to death. The bottom scared me to death. And I would say, Lord, your word said you'd send the angels of the Lord to take care of us. And they encamp around about them that fear you. And just go with me, and I'll go. Well, he sent for me to come to his place. And he said, I'll have a man at the bottom of the stairs to see that no harm comes to you, I want you to come and pray with my wife. He called her his wife. And I got down there and my eyes rolling around looking, you know, and sure enough, there was men down there and took me up the stairs and into the room. And he had me pray. There she was, real bad off in bed, and had me pray over. And he sat there at the foot of the bed, tears streaming down his cheeks.
Can you?
They were some of the most wonderful people, to be wicked as they were supposed to be. Humble.
Can you describe 20 grand, what you saw when you went in there? Do you remember it?
I didn't get to go in the place. I went on a stairway that run up
beside
the place.
Oh, beside the place.
Like you come up my stairs.
Yes. Okay.
Well, there was a partition where my rail is. There was a partition between there where I came up and threw a door into her room.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that partition was where the rest of 20 grand's was. So I didn't get to see in the place, in which I really wasn't anxious to.
No, I wasn't implying that you were.
No, but I mean, you know, well, curiosity, I guess it should have been, but I was just kind of frightened of those people.
But yet you seem to indicate they're almost led double lives, that there could be all this wickedness and sin going
on. They were wicked. It's like you step on a snake, I guess, automatically. That snake's going to defend itself. Only thing it knows to do is bite or curl up or something to attack.
Mm-hmm.
So if I went in a different attitude, they were God-fearing people.
Yeah.
I don't believe, to my remembrance, I ever met one that really wasn't God-fearing. There was this one man by the name, I believe it was John Phillips. He lived in an old shanty at the end of this street I'm talking about. Would you say Clinton?
Clinton, yes.
Down on the river
side, okay.
Right at the riverbank. Well, they told me, says, now, whatever you do, don't you go down there now knocking on his door, because, oh, he don't want to be bothered with any Christian people. He don't want nothing to do with God or nobody. He killed somebody. Said he murdered somebody. Well, you know, one day, I can't exactly remember just where I met him, but I met him, and I began to talk to him about the Lord. And that man gave his life to Christ. Now, those are the kind of people that was in the bottom.
Sounds like if you took the time and had the courage to approach them and work with them, that things could be accomplished.
I tell you this much. I know your time's short, too, probably. You have to go to school. But while I had this church down there on Wilkson Street in the Crawl, I was just ignorant enough, I reckon, to simply believe that what I read in the Bible was true, and if it said whatever you could do, if you did it in the name of the Lord, you could do it, except I never did raise the dead, nothing like that. I've seen a lot of sick healed. But anyway, these people could not read and write. Well, that broke my heart. So I went and bought pencil and paper, and I went bumming and everything for help. People get me stuff to help teach these people how to read and write. Well, there were some of them that I saw it was going to take a lot of teaching, and Christmas rolled around, and I wanted to put on a Christmas play for them. So they were old and young alike. They did not know how to even sign their name.
Was this members of your congregation?
In this congregation of these people from down there in the Crawl.
Oh.
Well, I always heard that a picture's worth a thousand words. I'm not a professional artist, but I began to draw things for them, to teach them that way.
Mm-hmm.
Draw pictures, illustrations,
yes.
Chalk illustrations. And for this Christmas play, I worked with those people, men, old men. It would touch your heart to see these old men as the wise men. We made, and they helped make whatever I needed for the wise men for that whole play or to decorate it. They worked constantly at night, coming in after they worked or whatever they did, to learn their parts just by memory because they couldn't read anything.
Mm-hmm.
We had one of the best Christmas plays I have ever been involved with in my life, and was the proudest. Even my brother, I got him out of jail to come to it. He had gotten on a drunk and was locked up, and I called Johnny West, and I said, can I come get him and bring him down to church? He said, yes, Vivian, Miss Follis. So I went and got him, brought him down to church, and he sat there through the whole play, and when it was over, tears in his eyes, and he said, well, I said, Susie, he never would call me by my first name. He said, Susie, you're doing a wonderful work down here. He said, I never would have believed it. And he said, this play is just something special. I said, when you see people that don't know how to read and write, and here they are, they're old, and they realize how much they have let pass them by,
mm-hmm.
you know, without learning and doing. And learning to read is a key that unlocks the door. Knowledge is a great key to learn.
Were their children, the children of
the... They had children and grandchildren. And
were they in the same state as far as education they didn't have?
Their children went to church. Here in the last two or three weeks when I've been... At that time, was still young and single, not married. And I want you to know those people, they're just as good as gold, and to this day, they remember me and then, and remember their daddy and all that. But those people, they come to church. They didn't live maybe like somebody uptown. They did the best they could do by what they learned. But now a lot of them, like I started telling you about these girls, they raised their children up in school. So now here they are with pretty good jobs and a pretty decent education.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a story I've heard of a lot of instances where people who were either born or lived briefly in the bottom or craw moved up in the
world.
But
some never escaped it but it was the younger one, like Mr. Choir's daughter Emma and Buncey and all of them. They didn't ever really escape it. They may now be living out a better way of life. I don't know if that's called escape or not.
Escape it in what sense? You mean the life they were living? Okay. The mm-hmm. conditions of their
yeah.
home might have improved when they relocated. But
that's what I'm talking about.
The life they led.
I don't know. But anyway, now they're more able to buy for themselves and their children and to do a lot of things they couldn't do then.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, a lot of people's financial state, I guess, after that period of time had improved, and work around Frankfurt possibly improved. But now their children, Emma and them's children, they're a lot better off. They haven't lived down in there mm-hmm. and known all that. So I call it escape, and there may be a better word
for it.
But
well, you told me about some of the places there. Do you remember a place called Rob's Funeral Home?
Yes, and my husband, every time Mr. Rob wanted his organ moved, he wouldn't let nobody move it but Bixie. And I sold some for his mother.
Miss Rob's? That was rather a substantial place, and one of the black residents remember it very well because it was one of the few black-owned businesses down there. Are there some other places that stick out in your mind when you think of craw businesses or places?
There was Christopher's Grocery. It was on the corner there of Wilkinson and Clinton.
Who was running that?
Christopher, or was that his last name? They called it Christopher's Grocery.
Can you just sort of describe it for me?
It was just a little frame store on the corner there, just a small place, one-room place.
And sell produce and meat and
yeah,
dry
groceries.
Goods.
Well, I don't know about any dry goods. He just, I can't remember any of that. But the groceries, just staple foods, I guess you'd call it.
Most for the bottom residents to come and get there.
But I tell you one thing, that when I married Bixie and I started meeting people, they would say, "You're John Foss's daughter-in-law," and I say, "Yes." Let me tell you one thing. Don't you never say anything bad about him to me. He's one of the finest men that ever lived. When my family was hungry, he brought loads of groceries, and when the winter come and we run out of coal, he brought coal to our house and said that was the story that people I would meet.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you? And I didn't dare open my mouth. I was scared. I didn't know who was what.
Yes.
John Foss, fine man.
Was he? I know you said, you know, temperamental and could be moody. Did he do these acts of kindness and generosity solely because that was aspect of his personality, or did he command loyalty from the community by doing these things?
I don't really know.
You know, sometimes...
If I had lived and known him personally,
yeah.
I could have told you, but I don't know, really. Like I say, I just go by what these people, he had their loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
But they called him the Czar of the Underworld. He ruled.
Yes, I've heard many many stories that...
I did have a pardon. He signed his own pardon.
His own pardon?
I had that somewhere, and I don't know in the papers if it's I've moved several times mm-hmm. since my husband died and sold my property and everything. I wound up here in an apartment. But I had a lot of things that I don't have no idea where they are now.
I'd love to find, if you ever know of anybody or can direct me, someone who took photographs of that area prior to its destruction in the early 60s.
Oh, Lord, I've got pictures of... Haven't you ever seen any of the pictures of the old store where John Follis lived and where he made his famous escape?
I've seen... The only picture I've seen is the one...
Let me see right quick.
Okay.
We'll keep
holding.
Or what?
Well, was he convicted of the murder of John?
He got away with it. He got away. They never did
sentence him,
whatever you call it. Let's see, this is what you've got, a copy you showed me.
Yeah, I was going to leave that with
okay,
you, but you've already
got that. Now that's some information, and that's my husband, and he run for jailer, and there's his mother, and that was when he was in service. There's his daughter died of cancer. And this is our daughter that we had.
And there he is there with the family dog.
Some of this, I couldn't get it very clear, and I had to get it in sections.
August 18th, 1929.
Mm-hmm. See, John
Follis
killed. And some of the other, I got it in pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know,
that was so large. They.
When they tried to give me a... And there's the store.
Yeah,
Mr. Follis, have you got that?
I've seen that one, yes. That's
well,
a dandy one.
I've got the original, but I had the original, I think, unless I gave that to the Historical Society.
Now, I've seen the original over... I think you must have given
that one. I must have donated that. If I did, my daughters never have fit. They said, Mama, don't you give him everything. You copy stuff, don't you? I said...
Do you think they'll ever do a book?
I don't know.
I wish someone would.
Well, Dixie always wanted it done. That was my son that's dead, and our youngest daughter. He wasn't Bixie's child.
Mm-hmm.
He was little when Bixie and I married. There's Mr. John Follis.
Ah, there's his picture there.
But my daughter must have the photograph album with the old pictures and everything in it, and she's at work. There's that one.
Well, you gave me that.
Now, here was where part of that's gone, but I had all of that, and that was the old place outside.
Now, is that from a newspaper article at the time of the murder? I wonder which paper that was. Do you know by chance? It's probably Courier or Herald Leader.
Frankfort paper, I think.
Okay.
And that's bars and liquors in the cross section of Frankfort were closed. That was April 22nd, but it don't say what year. But I.
April 22nd.
In the cross section of Frankfort by city police and state highway patrolmen after a series of street fights. That's what. Involving Negroes and whites, Chief Police Guy Wainscott, so you could determine the year by when Guy Wainscott was in.
Okay.
The chief said he acted under orders from Mayor Arthur Jones, and that's...
That really picked.
That must have been 50s? Let's see. James Owens, Negro, a student at Kentucky State College, was booked on a charge of disorderly conduct. The chief said, and he suffered head and face cuts. Bixie Follis, a city fireman, was hospitalized with head injuries. Patrolman Walter Gritton said the trouble developed after Follis came to him and reported that three Negroes pushed his wife off the sidewalk and said something to her. So then that was all about that.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the text of that article is in that little handout. Well, we can get the date from Mayor Arthur Jones's term in office.
This one's about, if you've read John Follis' primary election day gunfight with a policeman has resulted in one dead and three.
Do you have a year on that one?
August the 8th, but it don't have the year on it either. I don't know how come. I think these were all in her scrapbook, Miss Follis' scrapbook.
Well, we know it must have been before 29.
Here's a picture of some of the policemen and all about them.
Okay. Was that...
That when he shot...
Oh, barricaded himself. And
Mr. Follis.
Do you know when that incident took place, by chance?
Well...
It must have been sometime prior to 29, of course, but...
Yeah, it was before 29. Let's see. That was the home down there on the corner of Wilson, but doggone it, part of it's missing. I ought to have a better picture than that somewhere. And this picture here is Mr. Follis, I think, and his brother... But it was from an old tin type. But they, I think, barricaded himself in here.
What I was told by R.T. Brooks that maybe one of the boys had gotten in a row, or the police were looking for John for...
Looking for Carlos, I think, for getting into the ball field or something, and I don't know at all. There were several different occasions. And this is the names and pictures of the policemen that were shot. And how they all riddled both buildings with bullets and all that stuff. Fowler's escaped and has not been captured. So I don't know, but you could...
Okay, that did.
I've got more than this somewhere, but like I say, my daughter must have some of it I don't have.
Well, maybe sometime I could arrange to meet you someplace at this society and make a photocopy of the file.
Some of the stuff that you want, and mm-hmm. I'll see if I can get... We got a whole book from Miss Follis, and I'm sure Charlene's got it somewhere.
Well, maybe you can check on that.
But I had started my daughter... I've got more than this because we did a genealogy workup for my daughter because Mr. Follis was her grandfather. Let me see if on here there's any date. According to Mr. Follis, he was never in the wrong. It was the way my husband was. And several years ago, a boat was blown up. Follis's hat and coat were found near the explosion. He was supposed to be dead. A year later, he reappeared in Frankfurt. Oh, Lord.
I know. It definitely deserves a mini-series, if not a book.
So, I mean, I don't guess I've got any more copies of this, but I'll see about getting some if you're interested
well,
in
tell
trying
you
to
what.
See what else. But the crawl, it's a lot of... Lot down there, there was Charlie, I think his name was Spaulding. I knew his family. He's another one that always told my husband, he said, don't you never worry when your wife comes down here, because me or some of my men's going to be looking out for her welfare. So said, don't you worry nothing about her getting hurt when she's down here. And I thought, yeah, the Lord's appointed you all my guardian angels.
A strange assortment of guardian angels.
Mm-hmm. And...
Did you say you had a map where you drew in the places that were down there? I'd love to see that.
What was on the Wilkeson Street and all down on the river?
Yes.
I was trying to... Kentucky River Mills and where it was on down
mm-hmm.
and what was along there.
Did you go on into town?
T.E. Kenny... Let's see, now that's where the bridge and Bell Point. And the sawmill and the planing mill was along here. And here's Wilkeson Street from mm-hmm. the trestle down, starting down. The books, I had them in, were so big that I couldn't get them on the copier.
Oh, you probably looked at those Sanborn insurance maps?
Those
maybe?
Old insurance maps.
Yes, okay,
and
I know what you're
see
talking
what
about.
The distillery and what was where and everything.
Mm-hmm.
The sand traps and all. And Wilkeson Street, here's another part of it, and what was... There was a river and those places. And places I didn't know were there, Schultz and Grimm.
A lot of them probably went out of business before
oh,
you
Lord,
ever came.
Yes, Lord, yeah.
They ever did. Came to Frankfurt.
And all of, I just got lots of them. I was trying to reconstruct all of it. So anytime you want, you'd be welcome to look at them or what I've got. I was trying to draw the whole thing of Frankfurt.
Oh, good grief. That would have been quite a project.
It's all changed so much, even from the time that I was a girl. This was 1882.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember Corinthian Baptist on Merrill?
Isn't it still there?
Corinthian Baptist Church? Mm-hmm.
There's a Baptist church still down there. What's the
yeah,
name of it?
It's on Clinton, First
that
Baptist.
That brick, what's the, isn't that Corinthian?
Yeah.
Or is that AME?
That's St. John's AME at the corner of Lewis and Clinton. And then farther on up at the head of High and Clinton is the First Baptist.
Oh, yeah.
But Corinthian moved over to Murray Street.
That's the one that's over there, that new one that's built over there. I bet they done that when the slum clearance come
it
along.
It is. It's a, yes, ma'am. They did. I just wondered if you'd been in the old one before it got tore down.
No, I never was inside any of them. Let's see. I know one time when I pastored the church down there on Wilkeson Street, several of the colored ladies from some of those churches would come in and sing or play the piano and sing and visit with us. It was long about the time they were beginning to try to make the change.
Integration, yeah.
And My husband was so bitter against colored people, I would tell him it was a shame. Some of the best friends I've got are colored people.
Which is strange because, I mean, he sort of probably lived and grew up in an area where there were colored people.
Well, him and Mose Marcus and all of them played ball on the ball diamond down there on Wilkes Street. And when Hyman Marcus had the jewelry store, they would all laugh and talk when I'd go in there with my husband about a ring or something. They'd laugh and talk about the fun they had and the ball games they played. I can't believe, I know when I helped to worked as a volunteer with the Alzheimer's group out at the center, and Mr. Hyman Marcus, they brought him over there for two or three trips, times. And when he saw me, he'd begin to go on about the good times him and Bixie had together when they was growing up, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is Elliot Marcus kin to...
Elliot's the son of Moses, isn't he?
I think so, but I'm not 100% sure.
Well, I'll tell you how you can find out all of that history on the centennial paper that was put out here the last time one was out. Little Sam Marcus told me that all that was a write-up in there about all that.
I see. Okay.
About his daddy and granddaddy and all of them when they first come to Frankfort.
Mm-hmm.
And I went in there, I said, I want to put you all, I'm trying to write a book called The Old Out of the New, or The New Out of the Old, rather, vice versa. I said, I want to put, like, the new places that are here now where the old ones used to be, and I'm trying to write about it. And they said, well, it's already been put in the centennial. I said, yeah, but not the way I want to do it. So, anyway, that's when he gave me a copy one time and showed me that, I think I've got any of that in here. I get things all mixed up when I'm doing genealogy. There's the old bridge between, goes over to Bell Point. The old Bell Point Bridge.
It's about rusted away now, isn't it?
It's all not rusted away.
Not much left to it.
No.
I've asked you a lot and I've taken up a lot of your time, but what really excited me is I had not met a minister from the area, and I had not realize that they had a woman pastor.
Well, like I said, my family came to accept it and treat me with great respect, but at first I went through a lot of, and I'll tell you something else, my husband, when I told him that I was called to preach, he literally run me off from home. He said, I'm not going to be married to any Bible-toting preacher. Said, I want a wife that'll stay home. I said, all right. I said, I'll just leave you in the hands of the Lord, and I'll pray for you. So there was a Bible conference at Paris, Kentucky. My pastor and this other lady minister that was in the church, Emma Camus, she and I took my car, and when I went and picked her and her little girl up, I had my son with me. He was my oldest child. I said, Bixie's run me off from home, not going to let me come back, but I said, I'm just going to leave him in the hands of the Lord. So here we go, two women just a-singing and going off down the highway. Just, boy, we was going to the Bible conference. Mm-hmm. That was something I'd never been to one. Well, we got out to the Bible conference, and I told them all down there at the camp meeting what had gone on, and they made me preach my first sermon. I didn't begin to know how to get a sermon together. But I did the best I could and got to just talking about things. I preached, they said, for an hour. So then, well, anyway, they went on, and the camp meeting was over, and time come to go home. Well, there got to be a little knot right up here, and I said, well, I'm going home because the rest of my kids are there and my mom and daddy's there, and I'll go out mama's. If I'm not welcome when I get home, I'll go out mama's. But I just believe the Lord's moved. Well, we got home the next morning, and I pulled in the driveway around toward the back door, and I went and started slipping the back door. Well, there he stood shaving, standing in the back door, and a mirror hung on the door, and the sink was there in a corner and shaving. And, well, he said, hello, honey, how are you? And I said, I'm fine. Oh, he says, baby, I'm so glad you come back home. I didn't mean what I said. And he went in the other room and come back, and he had ordered me a Thompson's Chain Reference Bible. He said, if you're going to preach and you're going to do what the Lord's called you to do, I want you to have the best to preach with. And he said, God bless you.
Yeah, sort of illustrates how so different his...
From then on,
he was supportive.
He was proud of his wife for preaching.
Well, I thank you so very much for giving me all this time. And what
I'd
like to do sometime
is... talk too much about too many odd things, maybe not exactly on the subject you want to hear, but if I could, maybe we can get together again, you can kind of get more of a sketched outline of what you really want to know. And
I've got, you know, other questions here on the slum clearance project, but I sort of got the sense that your congregation business leaders handled that.
Yeah, there was a board, and they're all gone.
You know, I've read
about all of them's dead and gone
in the newspapers where a lot of the residents in the community resented the project and fought it. They got a petition up and people signed a petition.
I think they did. I can't remember.
Even had some lawyers come over from Lexington, and it may have been the blacks more so than the whites.
I don't remember for certain on that.
Yeah,
they were so busy involved in the church program and getting it moved.
Do you know if the church felt like they got a fair price for their buildings and
relocation? At first we didn't. So Bixie, I think, went to a lawyer and they upped it. But I don't remember how much they gave us more than they'd first offered.
Oh, really? So you had to get back and dicker with them on it.
Uh-huh.
They didn't actually condemn your property, did they?
They were going to take it, clear. They were going to tear it down.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Condemn
they had to tear it down to come because it was right on Wilson Street. They were going to clean all that out.
I know some of the businesses and people, the city bought their property and they had to rent from the city until they could find relocation housing or a new place for their business. Do you remember if the church had to pay rent to the city or?
No, we didn't have, because we sold the church and moved to Bell Point, so we didn't have to do anything like that. Yeah, it broke my heart and they tore it down. Been a lot of good times down there and a lot of friends made, and a lot of victories won, a lot of battles fought against the devil.
Is the church that relocated over in Bell Point still going?
No. After I put it in the Church of God, you know what they done?
What?
They sold it.
They sold the building?
Sold the property, put the money in the Church of God fund, and put it into another church somewhere.
What happened to the congregation? What happened to the people? They just scattered? Or?
For a while, they kind of scattered, and then... I don't know if Tommy Barnes still has it or not, but he bought the property, I believe. He was come out of the Baptist Church and became an independent minister, and has been a minister for a number of years now. And I think he's still over there. Maybe some of them still going there to his congregation. I don't know. I've never been over there since the day that I walked out and I got down sick is how come us to put it in the Church of God. I couldn't any longer pastor.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to give up pastoring and never have gone back to pastoring. I did some evangelistic work on Whitesburg and different places for a while. But I was sick for a long time, and so I never did do that. But I don't know if any of them are going over there or not, but so many of them are dead and gone.
Yeah. When they relocated all the families out of there, do you know, did they tend to put them in one area or did they scatter?
They just went wherever they wanted to buy or go or rent. If they didn't own their place, they had to just find. A lot of them went out here at Ball Knob.
Mm-hmm.
They often call that the new crawl.
Oh,
so many of them went out that way, out in Ball Knob, out that direction.
I had not heard that.
And when I was working, and there'd be people come sometimes over by the hospital, and this one man, he'd say, oh, that's somebody from out to the old Ball Knob bunch. Excuse me.
Last thing, and then I'll be out of... Now that crawl is gone... And we've had the Capitol Plaza Tower for almost 20 years now.
Has it been that long?
It opened in 72 or 73, so we're looking at 18 years.
I guess it did, because my husband was still living. We went down to the sports thing to shows and things they had.
Mm-hmm. When you look back on it, what was it a good thing for the community or
Well, what? It was bound to have been, Jim, a good thing for the community. People are reluctant to change themselves or their surroundings. Sometimes they have to be forced into it. And some people, they're grudgingly, like a lot of them probably did, and didn't want to accept a change. I'm that way as I've gotten older. I hate change. I have... regretted ever having to give up the home where Bixie and I lived in Bell Point for 25 years. It was the first real roots. It wasn't a modern home, But it was where we put labors of love into it, and we bought it, and I could see things. I'd fix new floors, and I'd tore out a wall, and I'd done this and done that and papered, and I'd entertain. We always was having the church come on, go home with us, and we'll all eat out in the backyard, and you know, and things like that. It had so many memories. But yet, on the other hand, common sense told me there wasn't any way in the world or any reason for me to live there after the family was grown and Bixie was gone.
And maybe that
had served its purpose.
The same with these folk, you know. It was home, but it had served its purpose, and it was time to change.
But they didn't know anything else and didn't have a lot of anybody or anything to pull them out and give them any better way of life. If you take away something, you've always got to give somebody something back in place of it.
I guess you have to decide if what they were given was of more value than what they had.
But we can look at it and say, yes, it was a lot better for every one of them. But on the other hand, knowing a lot of these people, the older ones as I did, they couldn't adjust to the change. They probably died in their bitterness and doing the best they could, not being accepted where they moved out to.
Did you meet anyone that was sort of in those circumstances? I mean, talked to anyone afterwards that said...
Yeah, because of course they came to the church over there for a while after the slum clearance program. And they were scattered out and here and there, and they always would don't see why they had to take our church, why they had to take our home. Everybody just wants too much anymore. Everybody just getting proud, you know. If you get anything better, they called it being proud. Right.
So some of them just evidently did not
didn't have any vision for the future, didn't want any better education or any knowledge. That's why people remain in the shape they're in. They don't have any vision. The Bible said, without a vision, my people perish.
I read that quote. That's a good one.
But with me, I always had a vision to do and to better. I'd look at them and I'd think, well, you're ragged. I have to run home and make you something, or I'll get something of Bixie's, or to make it all better, give you something clean, lift you up. But with them, they didn't particularly want to do that.
Or they didn't see the need to.
They couldn't look in the mirror and see how filthy they were.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, filthy. If they had, they'd have got up and done something about it.
But like you said earlier, they may not have known anything else.
That's what I'm talking about. That's the only way they lived. The Bible said, don't it about a hog returned to his wallow. Well, why did he do that? Did you ever think of that?
Out of ignorance.
He didn't know any place else to go, did he?
He was
that was comfortable.
Yeah. Well, let me say this to you. If we can get together again sometime and maybe not necessarily talk, but I would like to see if you found Mrs. Follis's scrapbook and wouldn't mind letting me look at it, or maybe we could meet at the Historical Society and I could arrange to get parts
copy
of it photocopied. I see two articles coming out of this, one research paper on the Craw and the relocation, and eventually a paper on John R. Follis and his life and times. And I'm talking about a short research paper for maybe the Register of the Historical Society or something like that.
Well,
if the family wouldn't mind me doing something.
What I wonder, I'm a daughter-in-law. Of course, I've got a daughter that's his granddaughter, John's granddaughter, so I don't know who has the authority. If there'd be anybody question that, Bixie had a younger brother, Ishmael, that was in Chicago. I haven't seen him since the day of Bixie's funeral. I don't know if he's dead or alive.
R.T. Brooks doesn't know where he is.
He doesn't
either.
Know either. If anybody would know, R.T. and Betty would, because they're the only ones that I know of he contacted when he come to Frankfort.
Well, he's been married 3 or 4 times and just kept switching things around, and they don't know exactly where he is now.
Of course, Betty is the granddaughter.
Granddaughter. Yeah. They've got a picture, I'm sure you've seen it, of John R. Follis's casket when Bixie had it relocated.
Yeah. That's what I'm talking about. I had all that. I had the original pictures. I don't know where they are.
If you happen to stumble onto them, I'd love to get with you and make photocopies of them sometime.
I know I had a fit when Bixie had him dug up and reburied. Miss Follis, she said, I don't never want to live with him no more. I don't want him buried by me when I die. Well, Bixie then, he couldn't have it the way he wanted while they were living. He dug him up and had him buried next to Miss Follis at the cemetery, and I said, she ought to raise up and haunt you. Because she didn't want to, but nothing to do with it that way.
I never understood why, she was such a religious woman, and she must have known
good woman. She, well, honey, he would take, He took Anna Lee Blackwell and lived in the other end of the house, that big house down there, the old Follis place, had her in one end of the house and Miss Follis on the other.
My goodness.
And Bixie would tell many a time about Mr. Follis going and getting Miss Follis and pulling her out of church with the hair of her head and taking her out and going to kill her. And him and somebody went and told Bixie and Carlos about it, and they followed him and found him, and they rescued Miss Follis from him. He'd have killed her. Oh, Lord, a hair-raising tales my husband's told me and Miss Follis has told me. No wonder I've lived scared to death till they all died. I've been reprieved, but don't you put that on there.